It's quite clear in the early teachings that mindfulness is a quality that never stands alone, that mindfulness is always part of an extended family. It's actually part of a number of extended families. But one of those extended families of mindfulness are these qualities of metta, compassion, joyfulness, and equanimity. They are actually what gives the attitudinal foundation for sati or for mindfulness. Without these qualities, it's quite possible that it's not mindfulness that is cultivated, but attention. And there is a distinction between attention and mindfulness. What we see is these qualities of metta and compassion, joyfulness, equanimity, these are interfacing, interacting qualities. They support each other. They nourish each other. Just as we see that greed, hatred, and delusion are also interfacing qualities that feed each other. They do not stand alone. And greed, hatred, and delusion, of course, these are, as I mentioned earlier, they're very big words, maybe not so easy to relate to, and we often use their softer translations of, you know, craving, aversion, and confusion, which is fine. You know, craving, aversion, and confusion are also interacting qualities. But it is really, what we really see is that if you begin to undo one of those patterns, it begins to unravel the others. So if you begin to undo the pattern of hatred or aversion, you are actually beginning to unravel the patterns of craving and greed and delusion. So the reality is that perhaps, you know, delusion is a little bit harder for us to access, because part of delusion is we don't know we're deluded, you know. Whereas actually, you know, we certainly know what it feels like to be lost in craving or greed, and we certainly know what it feels like to be lost or locked into ill will or aversion. Which is why metta is really the foundational quality of all of the other qualities, because it is our way of meeting aversion, it's our way of meeting ill will or hatred, to actually cultivate metta in the midst of this. Now, this is not about feeling something, and it's so important we acknowledge that. You know, it's not about having a particular metta feeling, and it's certainly not about sending metta. You know, this is not a sort of, you know, FedEx service, you know, sending metta. We don't send metta. But we do learn to cultivate this behavioral gesture of the mind. And metta is a behavioral gesture of the mind, of inclining the mind towards befriending what we are more automatically prone to abandon. So it's a behavioral gesture of the mind in the midst of ill will, in the midst of aversion, in all of its different forms. And, you know, most folk, I think, would recognize that they don't have to hunt too far for the arising of moments of aversion. So our classrooms are at hand. You know, our classrooms are readily available to us. But for us to really make or undertake that behavioral gesture of the mind, of inclining the mind towards befriending, we have to really want to. You know, we have to have really, I think, deeply appreciated the power and the outcomes of aversion and ill will. We have to be really willing. We have to be really willing. This is not a task of ambivalence, you know. It's not a task that's accomplished with a sort of lukewarm aspiration. It is really actually a commitment of the heart. It's not surprising that in more conventional practices of metta that the difficult person is really put at the end of the series of people that we go through. Just as it's not surprising that, you know, we actually need to cultivate the skills, I think, to be with the difficult events and circumstances of our lives, you know, rather than choosing the options of flight or closing down or contracting. It's actually about expanding our circle of concern. And here we really see where it is an insight practice, where it's a practice of understanding the outcomes of aversion, understanding the impact of aversion, understanding the conditions for aversion to arise, and really beginning to explore what it means to be a good friend to, or to befriend that which we are prone to abandon. Now, there's many ways. The Buddha was not a very, he wasn't into vagueness, you know. He got actually quite specific about much of this. He used when he spoke about, you know, what does it mean to be a friend to something? Well, he put this really into the realm of human relationship first. And he talked about the seven qualities of a good friend. He said, a friend gives what it is hard to give. So think about this in relationship to, you know, people that you might be averse to in life. What is it hard to give? You know, forgiveness, care, compassion, space, understanding. A friend gives what it is hard to give and does what it is hard to do. Think about that, about approaching a situation that, you know, that you just want to turn away from or judge or blame. Does what it is hard to do. A friend forgives you your harsh words and acts and endures what is hard to endure. And endures what is hard to endure. Aversion is uncomfortable. You know, it's unpleasant, it's a painful feeling, you know. There are times of people in our lives, aren't they, where they speak harshly and, you know, it's just hard to endure it. Sometimes people are just hard to endure. Endures what it is hard to endure. And this is not pointing towards some sort of clenched teeth, you know, mechanism. But the willingness to stay close to discomfort in the service of a deeper aspiration. And that is often necessary or asked of us in our life. A friend tells you their secrets and preserves your confidences. Speaks about boundaries, about, you know, about honesty, about truthfulness and respect for that. A friend doesn't forsake you in times of difficulties, nor do they roughly despise you. Isn't this speaking to all of the opposites of the mechanisms of ill will? How easy through ill will it is to judge or to blame or to shame or to treat another or to forsake. The person here in whom these qualities are found is a friend, and one desiring a friend should resort to such a person. Now, as I mentioned, I think when the Buddha speaks about these different categories, he speaks about them both externally and internally. What it actually means to be a good friend to ourselves, not forsaking, not treating harshly, not judging, bearing what it is hard to bear. Bearing what it is hard to bear. That this steadfast nature of metta is one of its characteristics. It's not a sort of a good weather pattern system, you know, that, you know, happy to engage in metta as long as things are going well and you're kind of fitting in with what I need. But, you know, it's really that steadfast nature to actually be willing to actually encounter and actually to meet the difficult in life. Aversion merits metta. I mean, so often when we hear metta as being the sort of, it's not a good idea to refer to it as an antidote to aversion, but it is what begins to bring some understanding to aversion. But metta is really also, if we think about it in terms of an path of understanding, it's about relieving distress. It's about bringing dukkha to an end. And actually, when we look closely at the very nature of aversion or ill will, this is certainly dukkha. So it's actually learning also to befriend aversion as a sort of ignorance pattern. You know, that we're not, that we're just sort of, you know, we're not voluntary, we're not choosing. And yet somehow we seem to be, as the nature of all patterns, finding ourselves enchanted by or ensnared by. And actually how to befriend aversion rather than our more habitual pathway of compounding aversion with aversion. As we cultivate metta, we actually see that this is actually a training, not really, you know, the cushion part of cultivating metta is probably the easiest part. The life part of cultivating metta is really the hardest part. But there is also a restraint element held within the cultivation of metta. It's about knowing what leads to suffering and resolving not to be a participant in the creation and the recreation of dukkha. So sometimes it means restraining words of harshness and unkindness. Sometimes it means restraining thought storms of harshness or unkindness. And metta is protecting the mind in that sense, and this is why, you know, we are not actually cultivating metta in an intentional way and cultivating aversion in the same moment. So we're thinking the thoughts we want to think and not thinking the thoughts that we don't want to think. And this is actually, as the Buddha refers this, this is called, you know, being a master of the courses of thought. So it's not underestimating that restraint element, and sometimes there's a certain amount of, you know, quite determination involved in inclining the mind towards metta rather than towards aversion. The Buddha puts it, looking after oneself, one looks after others. Looking after others, one looks after oneself. How does one look after others? By looking after oneself, by cultivating mindfulness, developing it, and making it grow. How does one look after oneself? By looking after others, by patience, non-harming, metta, and care. Okay, so that's where I want to end with the metta piece. So before moving on, I just want to see, is everybody, anybody have any confusions? So, totally clear? Any questions? Did you have a question? No? Not for now. Yeah.
Where trust falls in the I
trust in yourself, trust in others. Trust in it is kind of quite a Western psychological concept, though, you know, the way you're framing it. I mean, the word in Pali is sada, which is to set our heart upon what we have confidence in. And what we set our heart upon or have confidence in, you know, we follow up with our acts and our dedication and our commitment and our resolve. You know, I'm sometimes... you know, just slightly uneasy in the territory of, you know, trusting in something. I've sometimes heard the mantra attached to meditative practice, you know, trust in the process, trust in the process. Whereas actually the Buddha said, question the process, you know. He didn't say trust in the process. He never said trust in the process. He said, have confidence in your own capacities to meet what you don't know. Have confidence in your capacities to meet what you don't know. And then you kind of have a sort of, you know, it's a little bit of a check-in about what allows your confidence in the path to unfold. Because, you know, clearly this is really central in terms of the presentation from the Buddha, to have confidence in the path, you know, but never to have blind confidence in the path. And, you know, then you kind of look. I mean, you've been around in the practice for a very, very long time now, you know. Have you seen things fall away? Have you seen, you know, unwholesome tendencies begin to weaken and have not so much hold? Do you find yourself able to perhaps be more patient or more forgiving or more compassionate in difficult moments? You know, do you find yourself even a little bit less prone to reactivity, you know? Do you find yourself more generous, you know? I mean, I think these are all very valid questions to ask of ourselves, because this is actually where confidence grows, you know? And to know that is a process. So the payoff is not necessarily in some future moment. You know, the payoff is really concerned with actually what am I actually seeing in my own experience, you know, in how I live, how I relate, what I'm able to embrace, you know, what I'm able to include, what I see fall away, what I see beginning to be more available in terms of wholesome qualities. You know, so I'm not quite sure. You know, it's very important to have confidence, but confidence really built on our own sense of investigation. And you know, the Buddha posed that as a very valid question. You know, am I actually making any progress on this path? You know, I know a lot of Westerners are allergic to the word, but, you know, there it is. You know, this pathway is filled with goals. You know, there's no way you can get away with that unless you just never read a discourse. You know, and then never read a discourse, and you can say, oh, there's no goals, there's nowhere to get to. Read a discourse, and you've got a lot of goals, you know. And it's quite a valid question to ask, am I making progress on this path, you know? And hopefully we are. And if not, if we don't see things falling away or having access, then we need to question how we're engaging with the process. So, trust is too squishy for me. You know, it's a little bit too squishy for me. Do I have people that I admire? Yes. You know, do I have people in my life for whom the practice seems to have made a considerable difference? Yes, that's good. You know, that gives me grounds for confidence. Yeah.
Emphasize the befriending aspect of things and the ability to befriend
Well, it's about taking care of it, really. You know, I mean, it's not, again, it's not about feeling something. And we, you know, in those moments of, you know, when the pedal's meeting the metal, so to speak, you know, you actually need to develop great skills. I mean, certainly I have found in my life that one of the greatest benefits of meditative training is not to do thought storms. This is one of the greatest benefits of meditative training, is learning how not to do thought storms. But that is a process, you know. It really is a process. And, you know, sometimes it's the simplest things, the simplest skills that we develop, you know, and really familiarize ourselves with and really naturalize in that moment when actually I'm holding my breath because it's too big, you know. Oh, how are my feet touching the ground? How do I really feel that sense of ground? What can I connect with that brings that sense of ground? You know, is it just that I really feel my feet tangibly making that contact? Is it that I just really, you know, focus on an out-breath? You know, I mean, I think of, you know, kind of like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, you know. I mean, some of these folks have been better at meditators at developing skill sets for dealing with overwhelm, you know, the three-minute breathing space, you know. In that moment, you know, you're really meeting the impossible. Ah, first you come to the body, you feel the feet touching the ground, you know. Then you develop a more spatial awareness of the body just now. Then you breathe just now. Then you notice the mood of the moment. You know, then you come back and actually feel your body touching the ground. You know, it's a little breathing space. That's what you do in those moments when you actually hit those walls. You know, it's really important. You know, in Buddhist psychology, we would call it finding refuge. Where do I find refuge in those moments of real intensity or the really difficult to endure? But the thing is that we have to naturalize and develop those skills. You know, I mean, you know, to borrow from Jon Kabat-Zinn, he says, you know, the time to weave your parachute is not when you're about to jump out of the plane. You know, it's actually we need to develop those skills in the good moments, the easeful moments, so that they really are assimilated, so that we have access to them. You know, it's unrealistic to think if we haven't developed those skills that suddenly we're going to meet the wall and there's going to be some, you know, little autonomous wise self that jumps out and knows what to do. You know, it's not there. You know, we really have to have actually built up that skill set. You know, and it is really, sometimes it is only a question of some moments, you know, of where is the refuge in this moment? And what actually have I developed to actually find and have access to that refuge? Because we will meet those moments. You know, it's a bit like the plane crash, you know. We will, though, meet those moments. You know, so we learn to develop the skills not to do the thought storms. You know, metta's very helpful in this, you know, as is samatha practices, are very helpful in this, learning not to do the thought storms. You know, they're just closed feedback loops. They don't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. We need to be really convinced of that, seriously convinced of that. But then developing the skills of actually where is the refuge in this moment. Okay, so I'm going to give a very sort of just brief introduction to this second of the Brahmaviharas, of the English word we use, compassion, and then tomorrow morning begin to really develop this. First of all, the word, just to give a little bit of etymology to this. In Pali, this is a compound word. It's anukampa karuna. Okay, it's anukampa karuna. This is the compound word that we translate as compassion. Now, this is a spectrum word. So the anukampa part means the heart that can tremble with. Okay, this is actually anukampa, the heart that can tremble with. So this really describes the empathic dimension of what we call compassion. This heart that can tremble in the face of suffering. You often see this in some of the bodhisattva images, you know, of the Kuan Yin, you know, one who listens to the cries of the world. The heart that can tremble in the face of distress. So this sense of attunement, this sense of empathy, this sense of deep listening. And the karuna part is often, at times, translated simply as an outgoing metta. It's what we do on the basis of that empathy. So it's actually how we respond, how we move in response with our thoughts, with our words, with our actions. So it's actually far more the engaged part of compassion. So compassion in Buddhist psychology is never described as an emotion or as a feeling element. It's described again as this empathic capacity, which involves quite a lot, by the way. And then this engaged capacity, the commitment not only to caring for distress, but equally the commitment to uprooting the origins of distress. Okay? So although we're often more accustomed, you know, to some of the Chinese portrayals of Kuan Yin in this very, in this very receptive, you know, very, very receptive pose. If you look at some of the other imagery, early imagery associated with Anukampa Karuna, you also meet the armed warriors. You know, those who are actually going into, you know, engagement with their crossbows and their swords and their bows and arrows, you know, who are deeply committed to uprooting the origins of distress where they can be uprooted. Okay? So there's nothing passive about Anukampa Karuna. There's nothing remote, which is why actually metta is often seen as being the forerunner of Anukampa Karuna, because quite frankly, it needs that intimacy. It needs that closeness. You know, our hearts do not tremble in response. We do not have empathy from a distance. And it actually requires that closeness. So metta is very much the kind of setting the stage for the development of Anukampa Karuna, because metta is establishing a relationship and a dialogue of kindness, of friendliness, with whatever is being met in our world of the moment, both the lovely and the unlovely. So when it's such a mouthful, Anukampa Karuna, but you know, compassion's a lot easier to say, so I'm going to resort to this. But I really, really would encourage you not to forget this spectrum word. So compassion is described as being immeasurable, as being fearless, as being unshakable, and as being without conditions. It's actually described as being the deepest motivation and aspiration that inspires this path. It's not particularly belonging to any school of Buddhism. You know, there's no school of Buddhism that specializes in compassion. Some of the earliest images of Kuan Yin, etc., you know, were found in Afghanistan. You know, this is where the first early imagery of some of these bodhisattvas of compassion. This was very soon after the Buddha's death, or possibly even during the Buddha's lifetime. So this development of this quality does not belong to any particular school of Buddhism. The Buddha described it, this is actually why we practice. We practice because there is dukkha and the possibility of bringing dukkha to an end. And the bringing of dukkha to an end is both through the development of understanding and the development of compassion simultaneously. I know sometimes these are often portrayed as being the two wings of a bird, but not in the early teachings. There are no two wings of a bird. There's just one wing, you know. Understanding and compassion are undivided. They are not seen as being, you know, there is this and then there is that, you know, or there is this alone. If understanding is not compassionate, if compassion is not rooted in understanding, it's likely to be questions about our sense of what these are. So, you know, the Buddha was very clear in the early teachings, you know, that this is why he taught. This is why he encouraged people to practice. This is why he encouraged other people to teach. Not just because there is dukkha, but because there is a real possibility of dukkha coming to an end. And the dukkha that comes to an end is not, you know, he's not speaking about immortality here. You know, that dukkha doesn't come to an end. You know, he's not speaking about the ending of aging or the cessation of illness. You know, that dukkha does not come to an end. But that dukkha can be met with anukampa karuna. But there is dukkha that actually has origins that can come to an end. And that is really the dukkha that has its roots in greed, hatred, and delusion. That this is the sankhata dukkha, or sankhara dukkha, as it is known. That this actually can come to an end. And this too, it comes to an end both through the cultivation of understanding, but also through the cultivation of compassion. And some of you, of course, are familiar with some of the Bodhisattva teachings, you know, which has actually really brought this quality of anukampa karuna to life, in my sense. You know, the Bodhisattva vow, the Bodhisattva, please, is not someone who postpones their own liberation until all beings are liberated. The Bodhisattva is one who really has this motivation of compassion really at the forefront of all that they do. And the Bodhisattva vow or commitment, I mean, it comes in many, many different versions. But it's basically, you know, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Afflictions are inexhaustible, and I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter and to understand them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable and unattainable, and I vow to attain it. So, you know, the basic kind of commitment of compassion, the commitment of anukampa karuna, it's kind of twofold, isn't it? It's sort of, it's recognizing the vastness of dukkha, you know, the vastness of dukkha, and the impossibility of ending dukkha, but acting if it is possible to do so. Simply acting as if it is possible to do so. And that's kind of, you know, really the motivation that inspires, I think, a compassion that doesn't run out. It doesn't run out. So when I speak, you know, dukkha, you know, because you can't really speak about compassion unless you speak about dukkha, you know. And you know, there's many ways of speaking about dukkha. The way that I tend to speak about dukkha these days is about vulnerability. It's about vulnerability, because I think sometimes people hear the word dukkha and it all feels a bit remote. But I think when we talk about vulnerability, we really recognize human vulnerability. You know, that as human beings, we are vulnerable to injury. You know, we're vulnerable to the realities of aging and sickness and death. As human beings, we are vulnerable to the implications of change, of impermanence. As human beings, we're vulnerable to the reality that we live in a world of unpredictable and often uncontrollable conditions. And as human beings, we are increasingly, I think, aware of how vulnerable we are to a sense of insufficiency. You know, one of the kind of core issues with being identified with the self is actually never feeling quite good enough, that we have quite a good enough self. And so, you know, this is the, you know, and you think about within those vulnerabilities what it is possible to really bring to an end. Well, we're not going to bring to an end, you know, the reality that, you know, aging, sickness, death are wired into human life. But we can actually do a lot about how we meet those realities. As human beings, you know, we're not going to undo the reality of change, and often at times anyway, how very unwelcome and how very sad unwelcome change can be. But we can learn and develop a way of meeting that without just sinking into despair or helplessness or feelings, you know, that life is somehow unfair. You know, as human beings, you know, we are vulnerable, you know, living in a world of, you know, where, you know, we're so encouraged to be identified with an I am. You know, of course, we're so vulnerable to feelings of insufficiency and never being quite good enough, you know, never quite making it. This is something we can really undo, something that really merits compassion, but actually a sort of area of confusion that we really can undo. So this is where we, the word karuna, by the way, as I mentioned, this outgoing kindness, it actually has its roots in the Pali word kriya, which is to act, or to turn outwards. So it's good just to kind of frame the language in a little. So this is where we will pick up tomorrow morning. And this is where we end for the day. Just like that. Just like that. So I'm sure there are, as always, some announcements or ride shares or something of that nature. Yes. And I'm glad someone knows how to do this.
Thank you so much for